Okay, so in 1915, so right when GR was discovered by Einstein, Schwarzschild figured out this solution, the famous Schwarzschild solution that describes a black hole. It also describes the outside of a star. Remember that the Schwarzschild solution is a solution to the Einstein equations for vanishing energy momentum tensor. If you calculate the Einstein tensor for this metric, you will find it's zero. And that means that the right-hand side of the Einstein equation, the energy momentum tensor, is also zero. It's a vacuum solution. So this thing is correct if everything is vacuum except for r equal to zero, where we don't even have a manifold because the not only the metric, but the manifold itself is singular there. All of the curvature components are singular there. Okay, so it's a vacuum solution. And this also means that it's okay to use that for all values of r not equal to zero, larger zero, in the case of a black hole, which is in the absence of matter everywhere. But if you want to describe the moon, for example, you can also use it, but only for r's that are larger than the radius of the moon. Outside the moon, outside the sun, outside the Earth, we have a very good approximation. Also the Schwarzschild solution, but wherever the matter starts, we have a finite energy momentum tensor, and that's no longer the solution, and there won't be a horizon, and there won't be a singularity then. So this is the solution. If we use the full part of it, then that's a black hole. Remember that the r equal to zero is where the singularity sits. The horizon sits at r equal to 2m. M is the mass of the black hole here, where technically the mass is not sitting anywhere in the space-time, right? It has to have its origin at the singularity because the energy momentum tensor is vanishing everywhere. It's just behaving the same with a black hole. A Schwarzschild black hole is behaving gravitationally the same way that a mass like the moon would behave outside the moon. And that's how this parameter m is identified with the mass. The Schwarzschild solution has the coordinates r, t, theta, and phi. Theta and phi are the usual angles. And r is the radius. T is the time. That's true outside the black hole. Inside the black hole, r is the time, and t is the radius. It looks as if these terms are divergent. They, in fact, are divergent for r going to 2m. But this is not a singularity of the metric itself. It's a singularity of the metric when represented in these coordinates. There are other coordinate systems in which there is no singularity, as we will see. Only at the origin, r equals 0, that's where we cannot get rid of the divergences. So now let's consider a classic solution here for motion in the presence of a black hole. Namely, we have an observer, Alice, who starts at a radius, at the radial variable value of r naught at time t equal to 0. And then she just lets go and is free falling from starting from zero velocity, free falling towards the black hole. Free falling means this starts vertical, right? Because this is the radial variable, that's the time variable. And therefore, vertical start means that you're moving only in time, not in space. And then she picks up speed towards the black hole. And then, oh, what the heck is happening here? And what's happening is that according to Schwarzschild time, she never makes it. Time just increases forever. There's a divergence here. And she just freezes towards the black hole as far as Schwarzschild time is concerned. However, actually, this is only a finite amount of wristwatch time for Alice as she travels. And as she reaches Schwarzschild time, to plus infinity, this might be as little as 5 minutes for her, depending on where she starts. It could be just a second. But in any case, it's a finite amount of proper time for Alice that it takes her to reach the horizon and crossing it. And so in a finite amount of proper time, she actually makes it across the horizon. And then she travels this trajectory. And you see the t is actually going down. And the r value is going down. But now we have the behavior that t, because of this, the flipping of the sign here of this and that term, we have that this one acquires a negative coefficient, the t squared, and the r squared, dr squared acquires a positive coefficient. So hence this becomes a time-like, r becomes time-like, and t becomes space-like. That's why this is possible. So the fact that time can, that she can only travel forward in time after horizon crossing translates into the fact that her Schwarzschild radius can only diminish. In the t variable, she could, in principle, go up and down, but not in the r variable. I wrote up to you, for you, the explicit trajectory, just because it's so much fun. You may want to visualize this and play around with it on the computer. This is the explicit trajectory that Alice would experience. So you here you have the Schwarzschild radius as a function of the parameter alpha that parametrizes the trajectory. Alpha runs from 0 here to pi over there. And so as alpha runs from 0, where we have 1 plus 1 then, and so that's 2 divided by 2, it's r naught. So she starts here. And then as alpha reaches pi and the cosine reaches minus 1, we have that this approaches 0. Similarly, the time variable. Now, the time variable, as a function of this parameter of the trajectory, has two regular components, two regular terms, and a third term that accounts for this divergence there. The proper time can also be calculated as a function of this parameter of the trajectory. So for every alpha, you can calculate the proper time, and you find it's a finite amount of time that it takes Alice to reach the singularity. It's just plug pi in for alpha, and then that's the amount of time, of proper time, that it takes Alice to reach there. Now that's all fine, but clearly counterintuitive. This whole business here with the t variable becoming space-like and the r variable becoming time-like, that's not intuitive. And in any case, to have a singularity here is not necessary, because Alice is not actually traveling anywhere infinite far. For her, everything is finite. So for quantization purposes, we better choose our coordinate systems wisely. And so I will now introduce two coordinate systems for Alice and two coordinate systems for Bob. Bob is somebody who is sitting far away, friend of Alice, but far away and not keen on falling into the black hole. Bob is somewhere frozen, somewhere anchored, and not in free fall. And Alice's two coordinate systems are going to be just like in the previous lecture on Tuesday. One is regular Cartesian, and the other one is light cone coordinates. And similarly for Bob, a kind of Cartesian coordinate system, and then the light cone ones, just because in the light cone coordinates, it's so much easier to quantize, because the Klein-Gordon equation becomes simply du, dv, phi equal to 0. So any function of u plus any function of v is a solution, and we know how these solutions look, and so on. All right, so let's start with Alice's choice of coordinate system. What coordinate system might you want to choose? First of all, let us drop the angular variables here. In principle, we have these theta and phi angles as well. But let's just freeze them for now. And then at the end, I will come back to what difference it makes to carry them along. But qualitatively, we get the right things just dropping them for the moment. This also has the advantage that then we only have a 1 plus 1 dimensional space-time to work with, and for that we can use the enormous size of the conformal group, the conformal symmetry of the action, to get some simplifications out of it. All right, so for now we drop the phi and theta coordinates. And we design the first new coordinate system, a new coordinate system for Alice. And let's call the new time variable capital T and the new radial variable R. We will have to make a choice as to where Alice starts her trip. And it is convenient to make the canonical choice, even though it's a little weird. We could choose R0 to be 7.8 times 2m, for example, right? But the choice, the only canonical choice, is really to choose the horizon itself. So we are considering here an Alice that is at the horizon and then just lets go, and is then freely falling in. So what would be a good choice of coordinate system for Alice? Now, first of all, she doesn't want to have to deal with any of this nonsense of the metric having divergences, because the curvature is not divergent there at all. The equivalence principle holds, and there must be coordinates in which the metric is regular at the horizon. So Alice will say, I want the metric, I want a coordinate system in which the metric is regular across the horizon, r equal to m. And while she's asking for regularity at the horizon, she might as well ask that the metric takes the simple form eta mu nu. Remember that at any point in the manifold, no matter what situation it is, cosmology or real life situation with all messy distribution, with an all messy distribution of masses, you can always find, for every point, you can always find a coordinate system such that at this point, the metric takes the form eta mu nu. So she might as well say, well, where I start, there the metric should be eta mu nu. So instead of having this divergence, she's asking for quite the opposite. She says, where I start, the metric should have the form eta mu nu. And the coordinate system just will have to be found such that this is the case. Remember, she's describing the same space-time manifold. It's only the dress, the coordinate system that the manifold is wearing that is different. OK, so she wants that at her starting location, which means for her time equal to 0, capital T equal to 0, and r equal to 0, because it's her, she starts at the origin of her coordinate system, right? So the point capital T equal to 0, capital R equal to 0, that is the event where Alice is sitting at the horizon at her time capital T equal to 0, at her location capital R equal to 0, and then she lets go. All right, so, and then she wants, of course, that this is her coordinate system in the sense that it's her co-moving coordinate system. She wants a coordinate system where she's always at the origin of it. So as far as her new coordinate system is concerned, she's always at capital R equal to 0 and just moving in time. OK, so far we are looking for a coordinate system which is such that at this point, when Alice lets go at the horizon, the metric takes the form eta mu nu. And as Alice then follows her geodesic into the black hole and to the singularity, she's always at r equal to 0, and only her capital T increases. Of course, she wants T to really be the time. So it has to be a time-like variable, and r has to be space-like. OK, but so far, we've only put a constraint on this new choice of coordinate system with regards to Alice's own trajectory. But a coordinate system is supposed to cover not just the trajectory of somebody, but also fill the space. So how to choose a coordinate system that has these properties and fills space? how should we extend it? And there, to keep things simple and intuitive, Alice will observe that, well, this is 1 plus 1d. So therefore, I can always find a coordinate system such that the metric tensor is a scalar function in front of eta mu nu. So that's what she will do. She chooses the coordinate system at which she's always at the origin, only moving in time but not moving in space. At her starting location at the horizon, the metric should be as simple as this. And then for all other places, the metric should still have the form some function times the Minkowski metric. This is going to be very convenient because we know that under such a transformation, under such a coordinate transformation, the action stays the same in 1 plus 1 dimensions. So therefore, we can immediately tell what the Klein-Gordon equation will look like and what its solutions look like. So now we've collected all the conditions that Alice poses on her coordinate system. Here is the coordinate system that uniquely fulfills all of these conditions. It's the Kruskal-Szekeres coordinate system, named after two people. So what you see here is the new variables, t and r, expressed in terms of the old variables, little t, little r. So little t, little r are the Schwarzschild coordinates. Capital T, capital R are the new Kruskal-Szekeres coordinate system that Alice chooses. It's a little messy, but thankfully somebody worked it out. And you may wonder, does the new coordinate system cover everything? And it turns out it does. So this is actually bijection. So we can go from the Schwarzschild coordinates to the Kruskal-Szekeres coordinates and back. Covers everything. So in principle, we can express, we can invert these equations, and then we get a little t, the Schwarzschild time, and the Schwarzschild radius as a function of the Kruskal-Szekeres time and radius. So this coordinate system obeys all the conditions. In particular, it obeys the condition that the metric tensor in these new coordinates takes the form scalar prefactor times the Minkowski form of the metric, which means that the line element is a scalar prefactor, a conformal prefactor, times the Minkowski type metric. We can also check that this metric obeys the condition that at the horizon where Alice starts falling, this prefactor is 1. Because we want, or Alice wants, that at the horizon where she starts, the metric takes the form eta mu nu itself. She can't require that to be true everywhere, otherwise the manifold would have to be Minkowski space. But she can require it at one point, and she requires it at her starting point. Now let's check. If r is equal to 2m, then this is 1. So therefore, e to the power 1 minus 1 is itself 1. And here r is 2m, so that's also 1. So we indeed just have the usual metric here. OK, so that's Alice's choice of coordinate system. Now, how does the black hole solution look in her coordinate system? Well, this is how it looks. Here we have the radius Alice's radial variable, Kruskal-Szekeres radial variable, and that's the Alice's time variable. Let's check out Alice's trajectory. Alice starts at r equal to 0, t equal to 0, and then she will freely fall into the black hole. But she has a co-moving coordinate system. This is a co-moving coordinate system. She will always be at the origin of that coordinate system. So along the r-axis, she's not moving at all. She's always at r equal to 0. but time is passing. And so time is passing until she crashes into the singularity. So here's the singularity, the black hole singularity. Notice, it's not a point. It's this boundary here. Now, we can ask, well, what are the light cones here? But remember, the metric is of the form conformal prefactor times the Minkowski metric, which means the light cones are very easy to draw. They're always like this. These are the light cones. So the moment Alice lets go and starts free falling, she can send messages into her forward light cone. But whatever she sends will end up at the singularity. So she cannot communicate to the outside. And the event horizon is here, right? Because that's at 45 degrees. So she can send messages, for example, to value, to smaller values of r. That's possible. She could send a light ray over there. That's possible. But she herself is not moving in r at all, because it's a co-moving coordinate system. The Schwarzschild radius, remember, inside the black hole plays the role of a time. So all the lines of constant Schwarzschild radius are of this. This is constant Schwarzschild radius. That is constant Schwarzschild radius. This is constant Schwarzschild radius. The singularity itself is constant Schwarzschild radius r equal to 0. And so, yeah, so the Schwarzschild radii are labeling time. And then the Schwarzschild t variable, the constant Schwarzschild t variables are these, right? And they don't correspond to particular r values. They cross various r values. But why do we even care about the Schwarzschild radii anymore? Well, outside a constant Schwarzschild radius would be a curve like this now. OK, so now let's say Alice has two friends. And one friend is actually trying to be a good friend and go with Alice. But you see, this friend doesn't do it in a clever way, because he's not going to meet Alice and cannot. No way, because the forward, if that friend starts here and the light cone is at 45 degrees, this friend cannot meet Alice before they both crash into the horizon. Instead, this friend is going to crash into the horizon independently of Alice. However, if this friend had started down here, then that friend could have intercepted Alice there. Right? So there is there's a certain window of opportunity if you want to follow somebody in the black hole and meet them before they crash. Yeah, you can do that, but not forever, right? You have to time it right to actually be able to meet them. And the 45 degree, that would be just light. So you send a message to them. You could do that, but not if you do it too late. And then there could be a friend who is chicken and doesn't want to go into the black hole. And that friend could follow a trajectory like this, even though that's not a valid trajectory, because that's flatter than 45 degrees. I didn't draw that well. That would have to be asymptotic here. So in principle, these people are at this point still outside the horizon. They could decide not to fall in. They could just change their mind and then travel like that. OK, so that's Alice's coordinate system. And remember, it describes not only Alice's trajectory, and Alice has this weird trajectory where things start when she lets go from the horizon. In this coordinate system, we can also describe friends of her who would start well outside the horizon and then, for example, freely fall in, or light rays and so on. It just makes sense to define this coordinate system with respect to an observer who chooses the canonical radius to fall from, the radius that's singled out among all possible radii, and that's the Schwarzschild radius. By the way, the curve here that describes the singularity has this form. T as a function of r is this hyperbolic function here. Now, Alice, for the purpose of quantization, may want to use light cone coordinates. And you know the trick, right? You define one variable, which is t minus r, another variable that is t plus r. And then you can write the metric as a conformal prefactor times the typical light cone Minkowski metric, which is du dv. So this is a conformal prefactor, just like we had on in the Tuesday lecture on the Unruh effect. Okay, so conformal prefactor and then the usual du dv. The Klein-Gordon action for a massless field, so let's assume again that on this background we have a massless field. And remember, we do that with a purpose. If we had the mass in there, we wouldn't have as much conformal symmetry. But we want to use whatever simplification we can get to see the essence of the effect most clearly. So we write down the action of a Klein-Gordon field. It always looks like that. Black hole or Minkowski space or cosmology or whatever. It always looks like that. But now in her coordinates for the Schwarzschild background, since the metric is a conformal factor times the Minkowski form metric, we know that the action is actually invariant and is conformally equivalent. The whole thing is conformally equivalent to Minkowski space, meaning that the action is actually exactly the same as in Minkowski space because this conformal prefactor cancels out. Remember that the G mu transforms under this, but so does the square root of G, and they just cancel each other out. So that whether or not we have that prefactor doesn't make a difference for the action. And then when we rewrite this action in light cone coordinates, we obtain this one with exactly the same transformations as we did on Tuesday for the Unruh effect, because we had this action and light cone coordinates got us there. It's only the meaning of these variables that has changed. But in principle, we had these three equations on the board already. We just didn't call them capital T and capital R. From this form of the action, we can immediately read off what the Euler Lagrange equation is. And it is du dv of phi equal to 0, just as we had for the Unruh effect. And we know how to quantize that, because we already have that for Minkowski space. And we know that we can solve all of the requirements of quantizing such a theory by using this expansion of the quantum field in terms of mode functions and creation and annihilation operators. Here we have e to the power r minus I omega u, and here e to the power of minus I omega v, etc. We have the left movers and the right movers, just as we had on Tuesday. And remember that u is given by these, the u and the v are given these light cone coordinates, given by these light cone coordinates, are the light cone coordinates, so they're t minus r, t plus r. And if you write this as t minus r and t plus r, the v, then you can compare with the solutions that we wrote down at the very beginning of the course. It's the same thing. We just didn't use light cone variables at the time. So Alice would quantize a massless Klein-Gordon field in this way. Of course, she's also made a choice of vacuum there, the same way that we would do in Minkowski space. So she would say, if I don't see particles, then the quantum field must be in the state which is annihilated by these A operators, both by the left moving and by the right moving ones. The left moving ones now are the ones, are waves that travel towards the black hole, and the right moving ones are the ones that travel outwards. So if you excite these mode oscillators, they describe particles that move towards the black hole or away from it. (Clears throat) In principle, we could say, well, good enough. So now we have a nice coordinate system. It is not divergent at the horizon. It is very much appropriate for a free-falling traveler such as Alice. What's not to like about it? Maybe that can tell us all the physics we ever want to know. There's one issue, though, which is that when we want to explore black holes, we probably don't want to fall into them. So it might be good to look at the same situation from the perspective of an observer that has no intention of falling in, but instead is somewhere far away and is just from a safe distance observing the adventures that Alice is getting herself into. So, and that is non-trivially different, because in this coordinate system that Alice chose, we have that for large radii, the metric doesn't become the Minkowski metric. It becomes the Minkowski metric times this scale factor. She picked her choice. She said, I want the metric to look like the Minkowski metric where I start at the horizon. But then she has no longer any freedom to also require that the coordinate system is such that it also becomes the metric at other places. She could, but then she would not be able to insist on the conformal invariance and so on. So, therefore, let's consider now the same physics, but from the perspective of Bob. And Bob is far away from the black hole and not moving. So Bob is stationary there, somehow suspended from the black hole. Now, what choice of coordinate system might Bob make? Well, Bob is sitting far away, and Bob says, look, the universe is empty except for the black hole. And if I'm really far away, it means the metric should be the Minkowski metric. It should be possible to find a coordinate system in which the metric looks like the Minkowski metric. And of course, that's possible. And that's his choice. So Bob says, let's find a coordinate system in which the metric takes the form eta mu nu as r goes to infinity. And then also says, well, that doesn't fix the metric everywhere. That doesn't fix the coordinate system everywhere. So let's insist that the coordinate system is such that, other than at infinitely far away, the metric should be a conformal prefactor times the Minkowski metric. Because this is still 1 plus 1 dimensional, this is always guaranteed to be possible. The benefit of requiring that the metric takes the form conformal prefactor times Minkowski metric, remember the benefit of requiring that is that if successful, if Bob finds a coordinate system such that this is the case, then in that coordinate system, light cones will still be at 45 degrees. So photons travel at 45 degrees. And we know that the action, the Klein-Gordon action, takes the simple form as in Minkowski space. We get the same Klein-Gordon equation. We get the same mode functions. And we know how to quantize. So Bob requires these conditions. Metric starts taking this form towards space-like infinity. And at all other places, it should be conformal prefactor times that metric. Bob's choice of coordinates will be called the tortoise coordinate system. And here it is. These variables are traditionally called T star and R star, the tortoise coordinates. In terms of the Schwarzschild coordinates, the tortoise coordinate for time is the same as the Schwarzschild coordinate. So that's a very trivial transformation there. Schwarzschild time is also tortoise time, is also Bob's time. But the radial variable that Bob uses, the radial coordinate, is not the Schwarzschild radius, but instead it is the Schwarzschild radius minus 2m plus this expression here, where you notice a log of r over 2m minus 1. So what that means is that for large r, far away from the black hole, this is just some large number. But then what happens as we approach the horizon? Well, as we approach the horizon, this goes to zero, because r goes to 2m, so this goes to zero. But what we have here is that if r is equal to 2m, then we have a 1 minus 1 here. And that means that that's a zero, so log of zero, it's minus infinity, which means that this r star variable ranges from plus infinity to minus infinity. But minus infinity means approaching the horizon. Right? So the r star variable ranges from minus infinity at the horizon to plus infinity infinitely far away. And this coordinate system simply doesn't cover what is inside the black hole. So what that means is that Bob's coordinate system covers all of R2 numerically. The T star ranges just like the Schwarzschild time from minus infinity to plus infinity. The R star also ranges from minus infinity to plus infinity, but it doesn't cover all of the space-time. It only covers the outside of the black hole. And you have to travel all the way to R star to minus infinity to reach the horizon. Remember from Tuesday, the accelerated observer had a coordinate system which didn't cover all of Minkowski space. It only ranged up to the horizon too. And in that coordinate system, you know, you could go to infinitely far in that coordinate system numerically, and all you reach is the horizon. And it's the same here. So R star going to minus infinity only gets you as far as the black hole horizon. So this transformation is invertible only outside the black hole, not inside. But then outside the black hole, this coordinate system obeys all the conditions that Bob requested. In particular, the metric outside the light cone can be written as a scalar prefactor, as a conformal prefactor, times a Minkowski-looking form of the metric. But of course, now it's a different prefactor, different from the prefactor that Alice was choosing. If Bob draws now a diagram for space-time, Bob will draw his radial variable, r star, let's say horizontally, and the temporal variable, t star, vertically. And then in principle, we can travel anywhere here to positive r stars or negative r stars. But we will never reach the inside of the black hole. If r star goes very, very large, then we are far away from the black hole. When r star goes very, very, very negative, we get close to the horizon of the black hole. A light cone looks like this, right? Because conformal prefactor times Minkowski metric means that light travels at this, in 45 degree lines. So for example, if Bob lets go of a rock, then that rock will initially not have any velocity. So that rock will start a trajectory that's vertical. It will sit at a fixed r star, but it will age. So time will pass, but it will not move. But eventually, it will start moving because the black hole is attracting that rock. And so that rock will then have a trajectory that takes it through r star values closer and closer to the black hole. And the trajectory of the rock will get shallower and shallower, closer and closer to the 45 degrees, which means that this rock will accelerate there. But yeah, it just keeps going. And it will never reach the horizon of the black hole, not in a finite time for Bob. The proper time for the rock, of course, is finite when it reaches the black hole. But as far as Bob is concerned, no. OK, so Bob has a coordinate system with coordinates t star and r star. And Bob also introduces light cone coordinates because it makes quantization so easy. So Bob's light cone coordinates are u bar and v bar, t star minus r star and t star plus r star. Notice that I'm using the same notation as on Tuesday. And notice who plays the role of the accelerated observer. Perhaps paradoxically, it's Bob, right? Because Alice is inertial. Bob feels gravity as if Bob was accelerated, right? So somebody who is inertial in Minkowski space would be just sitting there and be weightless. Somebody who's accelerated feels, some pressure, like when you are in a fighter jet at 8G, you feel that you're being accelerated. So that was the experience of the accelerated observer that we talked about on Tuesday. Now today we talk about Alice and Bob, and Alice is the one who is feeling weightless. She's just freely floating, whereas Bob is sitting somewhere fixed, far away from the black hole, but nevertheless, if Bob was not fixed, Bob would freely fall. But Bob is not freely falling, which means Bob feels some pull from the black hole, and that to Bob feels exactly the same by the equivalence principle as if Bob was accelerated. So no wonder that Bob plays that role of the accelerated observer here. Also, remember that Bob's coordinate system doesn't cover all of space-time. It only covers the outside of the black hole. It reaches only as far as the horizon that Bob sees. Remember, Alice doesn't have a horizon, but Bob does. So there's another similarity. So similar then to Tuesday, we introduce the light cone coordinates u bar and v bar for Bob. And then for Bob, in his light cone coordinates, the metric takes the form conformal prefactor times du bar dv bar. Now let's see what happens as we go infinitely far away from the black hole. As r goes to infinity, we have that this term goes to zero, and therefore the metric just becomes, the line element just becomes du bar dv bar. Just like here, if r goes to infinity, I mean if r star goes to infinity, then r goes to infinity. And then this thing goes away, and we just have the Minkowski form of the metric.
Is the correspondence between the accelerated observer and Bob only qualitative, or can it be like quantitative? Like, is there a bijection between the Rindler wedge and the region of space-time that Bob...
Yes and no. The meanings are indeed different because in Tuesday's lecture, we had no curvature, no gravity. And now we actually have gravity. So we're really dealing with two different space-times. However, because we've simplified things to 2D and to the massless case, it will turn out that key equations are the same. And yet we should keep in mind that it's two different situations of physics. Because the equivalence principle is a local principle. And globally, you can distinguish whether you are being accelerated or whether you're exposed to gravity. Because if you're accelerated, you're accelerated in some direction, and every part of you is accelerated the same amount. But if you're exposed to gravity, then you can have tidal forces. Parts of you can experience different gravity, and that's not contradicting the equivalence principle. It's perfectly normal that this is the case. And that's what we have here. In an actual black hole, if you are whether you're falling towards a black hole or you're in a rocket that's being accelerated, you can tell the difference. Because if you're in a rocket that's being accelerated, then all parts of you and all parts of the rocket are exposed to the same acceleration. But if you are in a rocket that's held fixed in space and being pulled at or pulled from or pulled into a black hole, then you can tell that some parts of you might be closer, some might be further away from the black hole, and that gives you tidal forces. Also, you could be at angles and so on. And you know, if that's where the black hole is, then my left hand is pulled in this direction, the right hand pulled in that direction, there's an angle in between, and so on. So you can distinguish. But key equations will be very similar. In fact, structurally the same. So Bob has now a convenient coordinate system, the tortoise coordinate system. Alice is where the Kruskal-Szekeres coordinate system. And both will use light cone coordinates. And what we can do now is calculate through these changes of coordinates with a lot of effort what the relationship is between Bob's and Alice's light cone coordinates. We should expect that just like on Tuesday, the U and the U bar are related, and the V and the V bar, but they're not cross-related. And that has to do with the fact that one is describing the left movers, one is describing the right movers. And just like on Tuesday, you can't overtake light. So a right mover is a right mover, no matter what coordinate system you choose for it. So what that's indeed what we find. It's a messy calculation to go through this, but you just go from coordinate system to coordinate system. And in particular, you find out how U and U bar, how U and V are related to U bar and V bar. And then that's what you find. You get here the light cone coordinates U and V of Alice in her Kruskal-Szekeres light cone coordinates. And here are the U bar and V bar of Bob in his tortoise coordinates. So for every choice of tortoise coordinates, U bar and V bar, we get Alice's Kruskal-Szekeres coordinates. We can only write it in this way, not the other way around, because remember, that can't be invertible. Because the U bar and the V bar only cover the outside of the black hole. The U and the V cover the out and inside of the black hole. So for every U bar and V bar, we can get U and Vs, but there are U and Vs inside the black hole for which there is no U bar V bar. In any case, that's very similar to what we had on Tuesday. Right, so here we have a formula that may look similar to what you've seen on Tuesday. Remember, we had this equation in a double box, double colored box. It was just like that for the right movers there. Okay. So now we can quantize. Or Bob can quantize. Bob can say, okay, the Klein-Gordon equation for a massless field always looks like this. And in this particular case, because the metric is a conformal prefactor times the Minkowski metric, we know that the action looks just the same as for Minkowski space, just that the meaning, the origin of these variables is a different one. And therefore, in the light cone coordinates of Bob, the action takes this form. The Euler-Lagrange equation that belongs to that action is this one. And we can solve that Klein-Gordon equation and the canonical commutation relations and the hermeticity conditions in this way. And we have here a solution to the quantum field theory. And we are implicitly, but I'm saying it out loud because it's worth saying, we are implicitly assuming here that Bob declares that if he doesn't see particles, he describes that as the quantum field being in that state in the Hilbert space, which is annihilated by all those B operators there. On the grounds that, as far as he's concerned, the equations of motion, the canonical commutation relations, and the hermeticity conditions are the same as the Minkowski space. So he quantizes the same as the Minkowski space. And therefore, that's the way that he describes, that's how he solves the quantum field. And on top of that, he says, I declare the vacuum state to be that state which is annihilated by these B operators. Or another way of saying it, that if Bob says that there are five particles of a particular momentum, then this B-Dagger operator has to apply five times to that vacuum state. This is quite non-trivial from the perspective of lecture 8. Remember when we introduced the unrelated detectors? There we said a particle is what a particle detector detects. And there we took a first quantized system, such as an atom, exposed it to the field, and asked, is the atom going to get excited or not? This is a different way of defining what the vacuum is. You could say the vacuum state is a state in which observers of a particular kind, unrelated detectors of a particular state of motion, do not click. You have to say of a particular state of motion, because we know from the Unruh effect that if you accelerate it, you will see particles even when Minkowski observers would declare to be in the vacuum state. So I think I remember reading in the famous textbook by Biron and Davis that there are examples where the definition of the vacuum that we are employing here today is not always the same as the definition based on unrelated detectors. I think that would be interesting actually to explore when the two don't match and how deep that goes. I imagine that they still match for the case of black holes, but I don't know how contrived the situation has to be to find different definitions of the vacuum here. All right, so but with this definition for Bob, I mean with this choice of the vacuum state, Bob has the following. Bob says, from Bob's perspective, when the radius goes to infinity, the r going to infinity is the same as r star going to infinity, then the metric becomes the usual metric as it should be. If you're very, very far away from a black hole in an otherwise empty universe, then it really should reach Minkowski space there. And therefore, very, very far away, if Bob's detectors are not clicking, then the state of the field should be the zero Bob. It should be the state annihilated by Bob's B vectors. Unlike what Alice did before. When Alice doesn't see particles, she would say that her vacuum state is the state in the Hilbert space which is annihilated by her A operators. And there's no reason that the zero Alice is the same vector as the zero Bob. So that's, of course, how we will get particle creation. So now let's look for a moment at real black holes. Real black holes have complicating properties, such as they have a ring down. If you throw something into a black hole, it will wobble for a little while until it equilibrates. It will, you know, emit some gravitational waves and so on, and then it will ring down. It also has a peculiar velocity against the rest of the universe, and the rest of the universe is not empty. There's all sorts of stuff. Real black holes also have angular momentum. They have charges. And even the mass of them can change over time because they might absorb material. In fact, they always do absorb material. At the very least, they absorb a lot of cosmic microwave background radiation all the time. And they might, in certain circumstances, also emit, even though that's usually completely negligible compared to what they absorb. So black holes are usually growing, unless if they're very, very small, because then they are very, very hot, as we will see. But the small ones would have evaporated by now. So we proceed from here with a much simpler model. We say, OK, real black holes are messy, but let us neglect all of these extra complications. And let us also assume that the rest of the universe is empty. So we continue with our simplifications, even though real black holes have some seriously more complicated structure. Like the solutions with charges and angular momentum are known, but the maximally symmetric solutions with angular momentum and charges are known, but very complicated. So in good approximation, we will work with the Schwarzschild metric still. Then the big question is, which state in the Hilbert space do we think that the state that the quantum field is in? So let's say a black hole has formed, And we wonder, what state might the quantum field be in? We have two candidates here. It could be the vacuum of Alice, or it could be the vacuum of Bob. It could be the state that, according to Alice, has no particles. It could be the state that, according to Bob, has no particles. But these are two different states in general. It turns out that the true vacuums, the true state that the quantum field is in, the true state that it's in is probably both. It's probably Alice's vacuum state for the right movers and Bob's vacuum state for the left movers. In other words, the state that the field is in, that the quantum field is in when a black hole has formed, is probably a state which is annihilated, which if you apply the annihilation, the right moving annihilation operators of Alice on it, then the vacuum state annihilates that, but the left moving annihilation operators of Bob annihilate the vacuum. So why would that be? Why would it be such a hybrid thing that the vacuum state of a black hole, not the vacuum state, I shouldn't say that, because there's always an observer who will declare it not to be the vacuum. But the state of a black hole after a black hole has formed is sort of a hybrid thing. So Bob will say that, yeah, as far as the left movers are concerned, as far as particles are concerned that would be flying into the black hole, Bob would say it's the vacuum state. And as far as Alice is concerned, she would say, well, as far as the right movers are concerned, as far as particles that go out are concerned, it's the vacuum state. So let's see, why exactly would that be? Remember, we are assuming here that the rest of the universe is empty. There are no stars or galaxies around. And then let's consider the situation from Bob's perspective. Bob sees that there's a black hole, and he sees that the rest of the universe is empty. Now, according to Bob, there should be no particles that go into the black hole, because there are no sources of those. So Bob can help us by telling us, I don't know what you guys want to calculate, but I don't see any particles going into the black hole. So it's a reasonable assumption, since there are no sources of particles around, the universe is empty otherwise. It's a reasonable assumption in this case to listen to Bob and say, yeah, okay, according to Bob, no particles are going into the black hole because there are no sources. He doesn't see any. But that would mean that the left moving modes, according to Bob, are in their vacuum state. The state of the black holes, the state of the quantum field in the presence of a black hole should be such that the left movers, that is to say the particles that would travel towards the black hole, should be in the vacuum state. So there shouldn't be left-moving particles, according to Bob. Which means that the quantum state of the quantum field, which is a tensor product of the left movers and the right movers, remember, they don't mix. So there is a system of left movers, there's a system of right movers. And the left movers, the ones that actually go in, well, there shouldn't be particles going in, according to Bob. And if that's so, it means that the state of the quantum field should be the vacuum state of Bob as far as the left movers are concerned. So the state of the quantum field should be annihilated by Bob's annihilation operators for the left movers. So now we have an idea of what the quantum state of the quantum field should be in the presence of a black hole, but only for half of the quantum field theory, only for the modes that move into into the black hole. They should be in the vacuum state according to Bob. But could it be that the quantum field is also in the vacuum state according to Bob, this state, in regards to the right moving particles, in regards to particles that move away from the black hole? And the answer to that is no. So it cannot be the case that the quantum field overall is in what Bob would call the vacuum state. And here's why. Remember we had from a slide just above, we had the relationship between Alice and Bob's light cone variables, U and U bar, and V bar. Now let's compare that. Let's compare that with the previous lecture, where we had also, we had an inertial Alice, and we had an accelerated Bob, and we had also an exponential relationship between them. And notice that it's actually the same formula, literally the same formula, if you replace 4m by 1 over a. But this tells us, using what we found on Tuesday, it tells us that this state, the vacuum state according to Bob regarding the right movers, is not a physical state. Just like the vacuum state for the accelerated observer in Minkowski space on Tuesday is not a physical state. Do you remember why that was? It was because the energy density piles up and diverges towards the horizon. And the same thing is here, is happening here. It's the same equations, after all. You just relate the acceleration of Tuesday to the mass of today.
Question?
Yeah?
So if he said there's no left-moving modes because he doesn't see anything outside the black hole, then why doesn't that apply to the right-moving also?
Well, from Bob's perspective, I mean, the modes exist, right? The quantum field has modes. The question is whether they are occupied or not, whether they're excited or not. And Bob sees that, well, there are no sources of particles that could send particles towards the black hole. It's just usual Minkowski space physics. If you have particles, they have to come from somewhere. And so he says, well, in the vacuum state, there should not be any particles going in. So there are no excitations of the left moving modes. On the other hand, Bob has to be open-minded as to what the black hole does.
I see. So he knows it's Minkowski far away from the black hole.
Yes.
He knows there's nothing out there, but he doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah, he doesn't know what's going on there. Right. Okay, so what we have is that Bob may try to postulate that, well, maybe it's just my vacuum or no vacuum, right? But no, because he can't get away with saying that the state of the quantum field in the presence of a black hole should be that also the right movers, according to Bob, are in the vacuum state. And the reason is that the energy momentum tensor would be divergent towards the horizon if that was the state. But that violates a key assumption. It's not only the fact that a divergence is not a physical thing, it's also that it means that our assumption that our space-time is described by the Schwarzschild background would not hold, because we have all this extra energy there that's piling up close to the horizon. Right, this slide is just saying what I already said in words. So in particular, if the energy momentum tensor diverges towards the horizon, then it means that the Einstein tensor is diverging, but the Schwarzschild solution is supposed to be a massless solution, right? It is a massless solution, so that just doesn't, it's just not consistent. Another way of looking at it is that if we consider the Schrödinger picture of time evolution for a moment, in which case the state of the quantum field is actually changing over time, not the operators, the observables, but the state is changing over time, then what should happen is that initially there wasn't a black hole. Maybe the matter that will form the black hole is widely distributed, and therefore it's basically Minkowski space because the matter is so diluted that it doesn't form much of a dent in space-time. And so therefore we have the Minkowski vacuum and all that, which would be Bob's left and right moving vacuum. And then the matter contracts and eventually forms a black hole. The state evolves. But if the state was to stay what Bob considers his vacuum state for the left movers, it would mean that that state would be a state in which the energy momentum tensor is energetically, you know, going crazy towards the horizon, towards the forming horizon. So that means that something has to give. Either the black hole doesn't form, or the state just doesn't go into that state. It doesn't. The Schrödinger equation doesn't evolve that state of the quantum field, the original Minkowski space vacuum, into the vacuum there. It's energetically prevented from doing that. It would also mean that Alice would see a diverging amount of energy momentum as she tries to cross the horizon. Anybody who is there, not just Alice, but anybody who crosses the horizon would see this tremendous energy density there. And that's conjectured not to be possible. It's a matter of the equivalence principle. It should not be possible for an observer to know when they cross the horizon. Because, I mean, to be dramatically affected as they cross the horizon. Because the horizon is not supposed to be a special place. You can always find a coordinate system even at the horizon, where the metric is just eta mu nu. And then it changes a little bit from before and to after. And in particular, if you consider a giant black hole, like Sagittarius A, or the even bigger black holes that are out there, at their horizon, the tidal forces are so small, you might not even notice them. Not even the tidal forces. In one of those galactic center black holes, if they're big enough, you might cross the horizon with your spaceship and then spend like 2 months living until you hit the singularity. So the horizon itself is kind of a harmless thing. But if the energy density diverges, then it wouldn't be harmless. It would be weird. It's even further complicated because the horizon is technically, I don't know, those of you who took my course last term might remember that the event horizon of a black hole is defined teleologically. You would need to know all of the future to determine where the event horizon is, because it's defined as the boundary of the causal past of time-like future infinity. And anything could happen. So it's weird that that should happen there, that energy would accumulate. Nevertheless, it has been discussed that stuff might happen at the horizon, that there might be firewalls and so on. But no resolution has been found to this. So then, what state should the right moving, that is to say the outgoing modes, then be in the presence of a black hole? We definitely want that their contribution to T mu nu is not divergent, preferably small, definitely smooth across the horizon, and Alice shouldn't see a burst of particles or energy momentum tensor as she crosses the horizon. And it turns out that Alice's vacuum for the right movers has these properties. Because of the properties that we discussed for the inertial observer of Tuesday's lecture already, because Alice is freely falling. For her, it's just like the inertial observer of the Under effect. Their coordinate system covers everything, and there is no piling up of energy densities anywhere. So therefore, it's plausible that the state of the quantum field in the presence of a black hole is Bob's vacuum as far as the left movers is concerned, meaning to say on the grounds that Bob doesn't see particles going in. So according to his definition, the ingoing modes are not occupied. On the other hand, Alice will say, well, I don't see particles going out. She doesn't recognize that there is even a horizon. For her, it's just smooth sailing all the way. So that the total state is conjectured to be, and I say conjecture because we haven't observed any of this, the vacuum state as far as Alice is concerned regarding the right movers, the outgoing ones, and the vacuum state as far as Bob is concerned regarding the left movers. Now, okay, so if that's the state of the quantum field, then what should we expect to see? If we took a spaceship and traveled towards a black hole, what should we see? Let's say we are far away from the black hole and we join Bob and just watch the situation. Then, well, we look at that state and we would conclude, along with Bob, no particles go in. Right? Because the state of the field is this one as far as the ingoing particles are concerned, and we are with Bob, so we have the same definition of what is a particle as Bob does, same definition of vacuum, so we agree no particles go in as it should be. On the other hand, if this is not the same state as Bob's vacuum state for the right movers, we would expect to see particles coming out, coming towards us, while we are with Bob. And then we can ask, well, how much? So that would be the Hawking radiation. And we can repeat completely the calculation of Tuesday using that in all of the equations, everything is the same if we replace the acceleration with 1 over 4m. And we calculated what the temperature is of the radiation that an accelerated observer sees. And remember, here for black holes, Bob is the accelerated observer. He's the one who's sitting in place even though the black hole is pulling on him. So he's playing the role of the accelerated observer. Yeah, the accelerated observer sees that every mode of the quantum field is excited as if exposed to a thermal bath, and it used to be A over 4 pi, the temperature, on Tuesday. But now that we have to replace the A by 1 over 2m, 1 over 4m, we see that Bob sees that there's radiation coming out from the black hole, such that, and it's all right-moving radiation, such that each right-moving mode is excited, has an energy expectation value that is the same as if that mode had been heated up by a heat bath of this temperature, 1 over 8 pi m. And what we see, of course, is that as the mass of the black hole grows larger, that temperature diminishes. So perhaps paradoxically, the larger the black hole, the colder it is. Unlike the Under effect, right, where the A is up here. The larger the acceleration, the higher the temperature. It's still a tiny effect, though. You would need to accelerate something really, really tremendously to see the Andrew effect. Okay, so let's conclude then what we have. Here's the summary of the relationship between the Andrew effect and the Hawking effect. Remember, the physics is quite different. There is the equivalence principle at work, but the equivalence principle only works locally. But the math, with the simplifications that we employed, is mapping really very, very closely as far as the outgoing and right movers are concerned, right? For the left movers, it's a different argument. So here's the summary. In Minkowski space, we have the accelerated observer's vacuum, the Rindler vacuum, and we have an inertial observer's vacuum, the Minkowski vacuum. Now, the analog of the accelerated observer's vacuum is Bob's vacuum in the Schwarzschild case. Bob is the accelerated one. And Bob's vacuum is also called, in the context of black holes, it's called the Boulware vacuum, just to give it a name. It's named after someone. And then Alice in the Andrew effect is just inertial, and Alice in the Schwarzschild space-time, Alice is also inertial, she's just freely falling. And her vacuum is called the Kruskal vacuum. Let me ask you this. Imagine we use the Schwarzschild solution to describe the moon. And now Bob is far away from the moon. Then what state should the quantum field be in if there's no black hole but just the moon? Remember, the Schwarzschild solution is then true outside of the moon. Inside the moon is a different thing because there's energy momentum tensor now, there's no horizon, there's no singularity. Well, in that case, Bob would say, well, it's the vacuum for the left and for the right movers, right? Because there's nothing that drives the state to the vacuum of Alice in this case, because there's no energy density building up to make it energetically expensive to remain in Bob's vacuum, in the Boulware vacuum. It would be very interesting to actually study. And I don't know if somebody's done that, but I don't remember seeing this. The critical case where you have not the moon, but something that's very compact, a neutron star, something that's almost a black hole. Right? And then you throw enough stuff in there to make it a black hole, and then see how you go from the Boulware vacuum for both the in and the outgoing modes in a sort of continuous fashion to the to a mix of the Kruskal vacuum for the outgoing and the Boulware vacuum for the ingoing modes. That's what we have when the black hole is finished forming. And that transition would be very nice to study there. Now, at this point, you may wonder, isn't there a catch? Because what we are saying here is that Bob is right about saying, oh, it's the vacuum in the presence of a black hole as far as the ingoing modes are concerned, because there's nothing coming from the outside. But he must be wrong if he tries to claim that it's also the vacuum state as far as the outgoing modes is concerned, because that would come with an infinite energy density towards the horizon. Everything that's there is piling up infinitely, and that's not a stable situation. So we disqualified that, and we said, oh, it's got to be Alice's, because Alice's is smooth and everything across the horizon. But then isn't there a catch in that when we now look at the ingoing modes, where this is the vacuum state, Bob is fine. Bob will say, sure, nothing is going in, it's fine. But how does that look for Alice? So what does Alice see when she's looking over her shoulder? So she's going into the black hole, and she is wondering, well, okay, so what about the ingoing modes now? According to Bob, the ingoing modes are in a vacuum state, but it's Bob's vacuum state. For Alice, that's not the vacuum state. So Alice actually would see something that's not the vacuum. She would actually see particles there. But would she see a piling up of energy as well, close to the horizon, in a sort of symmetric trade-off, right? So whenever Bob sees a divergence of energy density, Alice should not see it, and if Alice sees it, Bob sees it, right? So don't we get, isn't that a catch-22, right? And it isn't, for a very interesting reason. Remember that on Tuesday, when we considered the Andrew effect, we said that we have two horizons. There's the future horizon and there's a past horizon. And it turns out that in the Andrew effect, we didn't have time to get into this, but now is the time to say that. In the Andrew effect, the energy density piles up for the right moving modes for one of the two horizons and for the left moving modes for the other of the two horizons. Now, for the black hole, we have only one horizon. And that's the reason why it's fine. Alice doesn't actually see a piling up of energy density, even in Bob's left-moving vacuum state. She would see a piling up of the energy density, and there would be a contradiction in all of that, if the black hole also had a past horizon. It doesn't. Real black holes don't. But it turns out that the Schwarzschild black hole, in principle, is a manifold that can be extended. And then if you do this maximal extension of the Schwarzschild black hole, you find that this extension has a past horizon as well. And that's where that would happen. But of course, black holes do not have, real black holes are nothing like that. Because real black holes didn't arise in this way from some sort of almost white hole kind of thing. No, real black holes arose from the collapse of stars. And that is a completely different space-time than the extension of Schwarzschild space-time, the Kruskal extension to the maximal size. So this asymmetry here, namely that the black hole has a future horizon but not a past horizon, not I mean the real ones at least, is saving us here and makes the identification of the vacuum state for the ingoing modes compatible with what Alice sees. I'll have to look up sometime what Alice's detectors actually would see. Very cool. Anyway, okay, so at the beginning, we dropped the angles. We dropped the phi and the theta. And then I promised that we would get back to reintroducing them. Normally, I would say, well, we covered the basics of it and, you know, the qualitative behavior. We got all of that and the temperature and so on. But since black holes are so important, let's just mention what happens if you go through the trouble and calculate these things really. And what you find is that if you keep the angles, then what you obtain is that the Laplace operator in the Klein-Gordon equation acquires extra terms that come from the derivatives with respect to the phi and the theta. And you can make them more palatable by going into the analog of a Fourier transform, because there, instead of differentiating with respect to the phi and the theta, what you can do is you can do a spherical harmonics decomposition, which turns derivatives into multiplications. And then what you obtain is that you get in the wave equation a term that looks almost like a mass term. You get an extra term. Here you have derivatives, but then you have this extra term here. It's a potential. It acts like a potential. Now, why would that be? Why would there be a potential suddenly, just because we took into account the angles? Well, it's because of this. Imagine you're flying towards a black hole. If this black hole was a 1 plus 1 dimensional black hole, then you will hit the singularity. You don't even have to aim because it's 1 plus 1D, right? You're going to hit it. But not so in 3 plus 1 dimensions. If you just, if your aim is a little wrong, right, what will happen is that you will miss the center, and instead you will go into some sort of orbit there, which continued would be elliptic, but it's not really elliptic. And that means that if you look at it just from the perspective of the radial variable, it looks like, oh yeah, the radius gets smaller and smaller, and then suddenly, oh, there's something that repels you from that radius, right? Because you never actually get to r equal to zero. You avoid it, right? And so it is as if there was a potential that prevents you from reaching r equal to zero. And that's what this here is providing. So it looks as if there is actually a potential in there. It's called angular momentum barrier. And what that means is that it is as if you have an object that is Hawking radiating, but the Hawking radiation has to make it over that angular momentum barrier. And that challenge to make it over that angular momentum barrier, just from the perspective of differential equations, is differently hard for different wavelengths, for different energies, for different momenta. If you have something that's very high momentum, not much of a barrier. But something that is low momentum will see this to be more of a barrier. So what that means is that the Hawking radiation will be modified by that. Instead of having a black body radiation, it's a gray body radiation because the spectrum is distorted. It's like, you know, when you take a mug, and if the mug is black and it has a certain temperature, then it will have a Planckian spectrum. But take a red mug at the same temperature, it will not be exactly a Planckian spectrum because the red is more predominant now. And so similarly there, it's as if the color of the black hole was a bit modified by that. And this gray body factor and all of that has been calculated, of course. You can see that there's a lot of just tedious calculations that go into this, but it's worth it, and luckily people have done this already. Okay, so now we arrive at a fundamental problem that comes with the conclusion that black holes radiate with this temperature. And the fundamental problem is that as a Hawking black hole evaporates, as a Schwarzschild black hole Hawking evaporates, it could be that it evaporates completely, leaving nothing behind. In practice, it's not going to happen anytime soon because black holes always absorb at least the CMB radiation. And that's always much more absorption than the emission that they could do. By the way, let me just ask you this. What do you think, what is the temperature of a black hole, a typical temperature of a black hole? Like if our sun is too light, but if it were to turn into a black hole, do you know what temperature it would have?
Milli Kelvin.
Oh, I think it's colder than that. The thing is that you can ask, well, what is the typical wavelength of the heat radiation, of the Hawking heat radiation that it emits? And there's a very useful rule of thumb. You see, the temperature is going like 1/mass. And what that translates into is that the peak temperature of the temperature spectrum, the peak wavelength, the wavelength that is emitted the most, is roughly the order of magnitude of the size of the black hole, of the Schwarzschild radius of it. Our sun has a Schwarzschild radius of a few kilometers. It's like 2.5, 3 kilometers or so, which means that if the sun could collapse into a black hole, the black hole radiation that it emitted would be of a typical wavelength of a few kilometers. And that's very, very, very cold. Right? For example, my hand is at room temperature, and so it radiates in the infrared. If you make things much, much hotter, then they will eventually radiate in the red and then in the blue and so on, right? And these are wavelengths of hundreds of nanometers. Like infrared is a micrometer, right? But a black hole radiates at a wavelength. That's not a micrometer, which is 10 to the minus 6 meters, but it's more like several kilometers, right? That would be 10 to the 4, so like 10 to the 12, something like 10 to the 10, right? It's like 10 to the 10 times colder than room temperature. That's what it would be. And room temperature is 10 to the 2, so it's about 10 to the minus 8 or so in Kelvin, roughly. okay, so that means that typically a black hole is always out of thermal equilibrium because it's way colder than its environment, and it will typically just absorb heat and matter and all of that. But if a black hole was completely isolated for some reason, maybe in the far future when the universe has expanded so much that everything is very much distributed and so on, and it could be that you have an isolated black hole which would just in a lonely way emit away its mass. And then eventually, poof, it would go. It would get hotter and hotter as it gets smaller and smaller, and eventually in some sort of burst that we cannot describe because it would require quantum gravity, it would just disappear completely. And then we have to ask, how is that consistent with quantum mechanics? Because if the black hole suddenly disappeared and left behind only heat radiation, then the heat radiation would seem to be in a mixed state. In a maximally mixed state, for a given energy expectation value, would be the maximally mixed state. That's what a thermal state is. But the black hole might have been formed out of a pure state. For example, you could have a bunch of laser beams that are all sending pulses to the same point, and there might be so much energy density concentrated there that the black hole forms. And you could imagine that these light pulses are pure states. So a pure state would seem to be able to evolve into a mixed state. And some say that's okay. But remember what that means. It means that the time evolution cannot be unitary. The canonical commutation relations have to be violated because conservation of the canonical commutation relations is the same as unitary time evolution. It also means that things cannot go backwards, right? Because you have this loss of information, you have dissipation. It means the universe can forget things. Maybe it can. But there's a lot of opposition to the view that the universe really can do that. But it turns out that the argument doesn't really hold water. It's not really true that just because the black hole during its lifetime is getting rid of its heat in the form of, getting rid of its energy and mass in the form of heat, that doesn't mean that necessarily the end product of the evaporation is a mixed state. It might be a pure state. Even though for all practical purposes it looks like heat radiation, it might be a pure state. And we can see that in the following way. Well, too many words here. Let me just sketch a picture for you. So imagine here we have a piece of charcoal. And from here we have a laser pulse. Initially, the charcoal is at zero temperature, so it's in a pure state. It's just a crystal, it's just a chunk of charcoal, zero temperature, ground state, pure state. And this is a laser pulse also prepared in a pure state. The rest of the universe is assumed to be empty. Now, what is going to happen? We have a pure state, tensor, pure state. And time evolution is unitary. The pulse will hit the piece of charcoal, and the charcoal will become hot, and then it will start radiating off its heat in the form of heat radiation. And that will go on for a long time, and the piece of charcoal will get colder and colder. At the end, the piece of charcoal will be at zero temperature again. The pulse is gone. But the universe is now containing a cloud of heat radiation that that emanates from that. It stopped now because it's at zero temperature, but there's a shell of heat radiation that moves outward. And if you stuck a thermometer in there, it would tell you the temperature of the radiation when it was emitted. So it would seem that the initial pure state evolved into a state in which the charcoal is in a pure state, but the radiation is just heat radiation, and therefore presumably of maximum entropy for the given energy. But it turns out that the state is, of course, still a pure state, even though it looks for all purposes like a thermal state. And the reason is that there's no black hole here. The whole thing can be calculated just with ordinary quantum theory. And the whole time evolution is unitary, therefore pure state goes into pure state. But how can it be that it's a pure state? Well, let's see. Again, initial state is where the laser pulse comes in and hits this and heats it up. Then the first heat radiation goes out. And that heat radiation is going to be entangled with the degrees of freedom in the charcoal. So that means that even though the total system, and this is now absent, even though the total system is in a pure state, the radiation alone is in a mixed state. Because if you trace over the charcoal, the radiation is in a mixed state. The total state is a pure state, but you trace over a subsystem. And since there's entanglement, you get that the radiation is in a mixed state. And we can plot that. And we could, let's say, here's the time. And here is the entanglement entropy. The entanglement entropy of the radiation. And initially, there is no radiation. But then, as the laser pulse hits and the thing is hot, radiation starts to be emanating. And it's just a little bit of radiation, so therefore it carries a little bit of entropy. But eventually, what will happen is that most of the heat energy is in the form of radiation. And only a remnant is left in the charcoal. And at that point, the entropy must come down again, because when this thing cools down to zero temperature, it cannot be entangled with anything anymore. Anything that's at zero temperature is in a pure state, in a pure unentangled state then, right? So it cannot be entangled with anything else, so the radiation must be entangled with itself, right? And that means the radiation itself altogether is in a pure state then. And there is a time in the middle, the so-called page time, where the entropy of the radiation is maxima, and then after a while, it diminishes as more and more of the energy leaks out. And then you have just the radiation is entangled. And in principle, well, we don't know that for sure, but it could be similar with black holes. It could be there too, that the black holes emit radiation which looks for all purposes like just heat radiation. But when the black hole evaporates completely, then all the heat radiation together, just like for the piece of charcoal, might end up being in the pure state. It's just that while there's a lot of work on it, nobody can really calculate it through. So we don't know. But there is the possibility in principle that maybe nature can forget things. Maybe it's not unitary. That could be. So here's a picture of this page curve. And what we have is the entropy of the radiation goes up, and then the entropy of the radiation goes down. And of course, the entropy of the piece of charcoal correspondingly also initially is high, and then it just goes down. And finally, a real black hole, you've probably all seen this picture, the first picture of a black hole. This one is not the black hole at the center of our galaxy. It's M87, which is so much bigger that it was easier to observe it, even though it's 55 million light years away. It's just way bigger than Sagittarius A, which is at the center of our galaxy. But of course, none of what we see here is Hawking radiation, because the Schwarzschild radius of such a galactic black hole is billions of kilometers, which means that, like solar system size, and that means that the wavelength of the Hawking radiation is so wide, right? It's so cold. There's no way that that we would see that. Yeah. Okay, so this is as far as we get.